This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Books Blowed Planetary Book 1. It's a bit early in the midnight hour for me to go through all the things that I want to be. I don't believe in everything I see. You know I'm blind, so why do you disagree? Take me. iFanboy Booksplode. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
Hi.
And we're here talking about Planetary Book One. Booksplode is the podcast where we review longer form books, not your weekly comics, your graphic novels, your OGNs, your compilations. We haven't done an omnibus yet, but that could happen, maybe. Anything longer than your standard 22 page, look at me living in the past, 20 page comic book that comes out every Wednesday. And this show is brought to you by the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy. They unlocked this show along with the Talksplode, and they alternate every other month. 2 months ago, the last show of this, we did the new Avengers trade, and so we're staying in that time frame by talking about Planetary Book One, which is a collection of the first half of Planetary, as well as a couple of extra issues of the seminal Warren Ellis, John Cassaday, Laura Martin series. That ran from 1999 to 2009.
So that would make this a little earlier. It's actually, I would say it's a different era than New Avengers.
Well, it ran until 2009.
Well, yeah, because... that's just, they couldn't finish it. But if you think about like the where the industry was.
It's a precursor.
Yeah, I mean, 99 was like bankruptcy. You know, that was Bendis just starting, you know, to be known and to do like Ultimate Spider-Man. So 2004 was like, I think that other book was 2004. I think of it as the same era, but those were very different times if you're a comic creator in terms of security, I think.
Well, and before we get into the book itself, one of the things I wanted to talk about was that for people who came in the last big wave, which I think was probably post-Civil War.
Okay.
May not understand that there was a 5-year period, maybe even shorter, in which Warren Ellis was the most important comic book writer happening. So he did Planetary from 99 to 2009. He did the Authority from 99 to 2000. He did Transmetropolitan from 97 to 2002. So I think from like 99 to 2002,
mm-hmm.
he was, I would say, the most important person writing comics.
It's possible, or at least as important as anybody else. I mean,
the most influential. You
could put him next to Grant Morrison, I think, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
They both sort of went in two directions, but, you know, both wacky Brits, basically. To me, this is interesting because you never really got out of comics, but I did.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading them when I was younger, say like 11 to 13 or 14 or something like that. And then I stopped. And then in 99 is when I came back to reading them. So really, this is right from my discovery zone.
Mm-hmm.
And Warren Ellis had a big part in that, I would say, in sort of showing me that comics. It's funny because if you think back, you know, you would say that like 87 which was when I first started reading comic books, 88 was sort of the year that comics changed into, you know, comics are not for kids anymore.
Yep.
But really, 99, you know, is the late 90s was sort of a golden era for Vertigo comics and these kind of Wildstorm comics. At the same time that he was doing this for Wildstorm, you had Alan Moore doing America's Best Comics for Wildstorm.
And Morrison doing JLA.
Yep, and this is before DC acquired Wildstorm.
Right.
This might have been around that same time. I'm not sure exactly when that happened, but I know that like the Alan Moore comics were not part of DC because he flipped out when they became
DC. Yeah, no, they weren't.
So this would have been the same.
Yeah, and you had Warren Ellis. He wrote Stormwatch, which was a Image Wildstorm property that was very Jim Lee-esque. Mm-hmm. And that became the Authority in 99 while he was doing Transmetropolitan at the same time. And then they came out with Planetary in 1999. And 99 was the year we graduated college. And 2000 was the first year you went to Comic-Con and you came back mm-hmm. with a whole list of books we had to check out. And this was, I don't know if this book was on that list, but this was not a book that I came on from the beginning. I came on somewhere, I was trying to remember as I was reading this book, but I couldn't remember exactly, but it was somewhere around 9 or 10.
Did you do all of it?
Yeah, so what happened was I heard, you know, I started reading, when you came back, and I definitely Transmetropolitan was on the list and the Authority, so I was reading, I got those books, and this was back, you know, when you couldn't download them, and you didn't really find them at the store, so I was a furious eBay shopper. And I remember getting like years of Transmetropolitan off of eBay. But then I went to the store, I think it was Jim Hanley's Universe in New York, and got the latest issue of Planetary, read it, and we'll explain why you could just sort of read a random issue
yes.
when we get into the story. Loved it, went on eBay and got everything that had come out up to that point. So I don't remember exactly. It was really bugging me that I couldn't remember which one, but it was like around 11 or 10.
Bought them. I don't think I did eBay, but I think I literally went back issue diving to get the first however many I read, something like 10 or 11 or something like that. Also,
I think we came in around 10 because that was when we discovered it. It was around that
and
time.
I have them, and I know that I have the first one signed by Warren Ellis, so that would indicate that I either got it done at that San Diego Comic-Con or maybe he came to the Golden Apple, I think, mm-hmm. one time. This would have been in the heyday of the Warren Ellis Forum as well.
Right, yeah.
Where a lot of guys who are still working today came out of
Bendis and Matt Kieran Gillen, Matt Fraction. They were all there.
Bendis had his own thing. Was he on there?
He would pop into the Warren Ellis Forum.
Yeah. He was already sort of a known quantity. Well, almost.
So
either way, it was a very fertile time. And I tend to think of it as sort of probably my favorite era.
I think that's clear. After the Gush Fest that was the New Avengers podcast, I think.
Yeah.
What's great about this show, the Booksplode show, was that when was I ever going to reread Planetary?
Right. Yeah, you're right.
You know, like I reread it when it came out in Absolutes. I have the Absolute editions that cover the whole run, but that was years and years ago. But like, when was I ever going to read it again? There's so much stuff constantly coming at us. But it was really nice to go back and reread New Avengers. It was really nice to go back and read Planetary and remember what it was like in that time. So Planetary was it didn't last long. It came out over 10 years. There's only 27 issues. It was somewhat regular for the first half, and then you started getting two or three issues a year for the next 10 years.
Which then became Warren Ellis's MO, where he never did anything over three issues, and even that was going to be a stretch. I mean, there's the thing when you said he was the biggest writer, it's important to understand that after a little while, he kind of went, I'm good.
Yeah.
And he did everything at his own pace, and he could get away with it because he was Warren Ellis, and, you know, if he needed money, he'd do an article for Wired or something like that. You know, right. he can live that lifestyle, which looks like a thing that he wanted to do. But this was from what I will say was a hungrier time for him.
Sure, he was, I think he was like 30 or something around this time.
Yeah. Before we even get into it, I just wanted to, the first thing that I noticed is that I flip after the cover and I see introduction by Alan Moore. I was like, what the hell?
Yeah, I had the same reaction.
And I go, there's no way that he wrote this for this. Dated Northampton, December 14th, 99. I was like, that makes much more sense.
Yeah, I did. I flipped to the end too because I had this exact same reaction. I was like,
what?
So I feel like that would have been
really impressed.
That would have been bigger news if they'd gotten a new Alan Moore intro. But one of the things, a hallmark of Warren Ellis' storytelling, which sort of continues to this day as he pops up here and there doing, you know, Moon Knight or Secret Avengers or whatever, is that, and we know this from being around at the time, he didn't really like superheroes. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what this book is really all about.
Yeah.
This book is basically anti-superhero and sort of pro-pulp.
It depends. I mean, you could almost say the same thing about Authority, but neither of these are super. Neither of those are superhero formatted stories.
It's not like Garth Ennis's anti-superhero. This is more like, I wouldn't say subtle because it's pretty out in the open here. The superheroes tend to be the bad guys in Planetary, but it's Warren Ellis has a certain kind of affection for certain kind of stories, and superhero stories aren't really on that list.
But I also think that, like, if you look at both of those, both and again, the Authority, Stormwatch, Planet Terror, these take place in the same universe.
Yeah.
So there's this basically, in all of them, there's, you know, super beings as kind of overlords.
Yeah.
Like, they're not actually in charge of everything. They're not monarchs or dictators, but really, the idea is that, like, really these people do have all the power and we're sort of at their mercy.
Yeah.
And so if they happen to be dicks, you know, then that's not good for everybody. And then, you know, vice versa, if they have to be, you know, nobody's like a shining good person in any of these.
Planetary is a story of three people, Elijah Snow, Jaquita Wagner, and the drummer, who are the field operatives for a group called Planetary, which is a shadowy organization that is dedicated to uncovering the secret and strange things about the world, the history.
And it has limitless funding.
Limitless funding, technology, bases all over the planet.
A mysterious benefactor called the Fourth Man, who's revealed by the end of this book.
Right, and they go around uncovering the alternate history of the world. And the format of the series is that, while there is definitely a ongoing story throughout the book, it's basically every issue is a self-contained story, which is why you and I could jump on an issue, we'll just say randomly issue 10, and read a self-contained book. Even though there was things happening in the background, it was basically each issue was its own mission that they went on, but at least in this book.
You know, stylistically, they would jump from genres, where one of them was sort of a Hong Kong action movie slash ghost story. You know, another one was, you know, more of a cosmic fantasy kind of thing.
Right. So I try to keep track. So here's what I have. So issue one, we got the Doc Savage Justice League analog. Issue two was Godzilla and those monsters. Issue three was the Hong Kong cop story, ghost cop story. Four, I didn't have anything for. Five was the Return of Doc Savage. Six was Fantastic Four. Seven was Constantine plus Transmetropolitan, where Constantine basically becomes a spider.
Yep.
Eight, Atomic Age stories like them, with the giant ants. Nine, I had nothing. Ten was Fantastic Four killing Superman, Wonder Woman, and Green Lantern. 11 was Nick Fury. 12 was the reveal of the Fourth Man. 13 was Frankenstein, Sherlock Holmes, and Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
So we meet those versions of these kind of characters in this world. And it lets Warren Ellis explore these archetypes and sort of remake them in this world's image, a much darker world. I love this book. Transmetropolitan was his magnum opus, but, like, I have a special place in my heart for Planetary.
It's funny because I had forgotten that. And I because basically my history was that I read it and I don't think I got it.
Yeah.
At first, really what it was doing. And I think that actually that lack of a through line, that thing that every issue was separate. And also they were referring to things that at the time I did not know.
Mm-hmm.
I think largely. If you look back at this, I was a much less sophisticated. I didn't have 18 years of a comic book website work under me to sort of parse everything.
Sure.
And so it's pretty interesting to go back and all of a sudden it's very clear what I'm reading, whereas the first time I wasn't. So I would say I wasn't mature enough to sort of deal with it, or at least, you know, I didn't know enough.
My level of appreciation now is probably even stronger than it was then. But even then, I just love alternate history, secret history stories. And so this scratches that itch in a big way. Plus, alternate versions of characters that I know and love is also fun for me.
Now, the thing that's interesting about that is that I don't know how I feel about when I look back at all of this stuff. And it's funny because it's the same thing. We give Alan Moore a lot of credit. But when I really look at the bulk of his work, all of it, or a ton of it is you know, referential to other stuff that came before it. And again, Warren Ellis, I tend to think the same sort of thing. But he sort of branched out of it later, where he was doing more original stories. But these are all of this stuff are takes on pre-existing things and themes.
Well, Transmet was really, really original at the same time.
Yes, it was. Yeah, you're right. But sort of his more mainstream work. It's and it was also very much in the shadow and vein of Alan Moore, I think, but with his own voice. Right? It's funny because it doesn't matter that this was from 1999 or whenever. You could read this now, and it's exactly the same tone and voice as the stuff he's putting out right now. But yeah. He is that guy. He's fully formed as a voice, as a sort of way of. He's a little more sparse now, I would say, but not much. You know, he's always got a character who sounds like one of these grumpy characters.
Yeah, they're all grumpy. Book. They're all really, really competent. They're like David Mamet characters. You know, they're all really competent. They're all grumpy. They all are tough. They've got one liner for every situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not original, but he's very good at it.
He is. Yeah, no, I think he's original in the terms of, like, it's his voice. It doesn't sound like anybody else. It's like John Milius is really good at tough guys, and Warren Ellis is really good at his version of tough guys.
And what he's really good at making it seem original is by adding in the layer of science. He's always been, you know, somewhat of a futurist. You know, he writes, as you mentioned, he writes science columns for magazines, and he researches technology a lot. So here you get a lot more. I remember, you know, so as it turns out, the bad guys in the series are their version of the Fantastic Four, and so we meet their Invisible Woman, and she has to wear goggles because an invisible person couldn't see because they don't have the light would never hit their retinas, and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And you just never thought of that in comics. It's just, you know, they go invisible, and he would think about things like that, you know, making sure that the visible person had to wear goggles or what were the real world ramifications of some of these powers, or at least pseudoscience ramifications of them.
Yeah, it's a really good way for like a pedantic person to make good.
Right.
You know, like in a lot of circumstances, somebody would be, oh, you wouldn't be able to see. There would be no light bounce. No, I have a retina. How would you explain it? And he manages to do that in a way that seems cool, which is quite a feat, really.
And not obnoxious, yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And also, I think I don't know if it makes a huge difference, but I think there's definitely... there's something to be said that this was work that was done before he was such a beloved sort of cult figure as a writer.
I think it was happening while, I mean, it wasn't
fully formed. Now, so there was definitely, he's always got a confidence, I think, in his work, and it shows all over the place. But like I said, there is a bit of a hunger here. His work seems very effortless now. And I don't really mean that in a bad way, but there's something about it where he's just like, I'm going to just do this exactly what I want. I don't really care what anybody says. He's still trying to impress a little bit here, I think. It's very subtle, and I might be reaching, but I...
No, I think like, there's a feeling of occasionally he coasts with a job. I think that's fair. Whereas here, he's not coasting.
No.
Nor was he coasting on Transmetropolitan or the Authority at the time. So to me, the big story here is... remembering why John Cassaday became such a big deal and seeing sort of the arc of his style. So when I see Cassaday now, I had sort of forgotten why I loved him so much, because his style has changed, and it's sort of, his characters now have a weird sort of plasticky look to them. And
I spent a lot of time while I was reading thinking about what the difference is, and I still don't feel like I could put my finger on it.
There was one issue where I saw it, and that was in the annual where they did the Hulk story. And I didn't know if that annual came out at a later point. The one thing this book doesn't do a good job of is telling you what you're reading or when it came out. But he didn't draw the characters the way they were drawn in the rest of the book in that annual. And I didn't. Mm-hmm. I just don't know when that one came out. There's a life and a fluidity and a moodiness in some places to his art in this. And it doesn't exist anymore in the way he draws. Some of the stories required a different kind of style, and he would do really shadowy stuff. And his facial work didn't look so... as we described in the Star Wars, you know, face melty, like it had a life to it. And, you know, between him and Brian Hitch, these books really changed the way a lot of comics looked and were made at the time. And I think this book looks terrific for the most part.
It really does. I almost feel like it's just like the inking has changed, or
I don't know what it is,
or like it's hard to color him. Or, you know, like it. What's funny is that when I think back at Laura Martin, I remember her as being sort of the premier colorist at this time, next to Dave Stewart, who probably got all of her Eisners. But still, she was the one really pushing, breaking boundaries, and doing it in a mainstream work. And now, when I think of looking at her work, it feels a little dated to me. But in the context of this Planetary, I thought, no, this is right. She's not overdoing it at all.
No,
certainly not in the context of the time when you. Think about how garish a lot of stuff looked then, and how bad. If you remember back at this time, you know, Marvel was really just getting into in widespread digital color, and it looked terrible. Everything was dark, and there was too much Photoshop effects and yep. prisms and shit.
Way too much shading going on.
Yeah, and she's really
Well, there was a reason why she was one of the best in the business at the time.
Yeah.
She figured out the tools early.
Yep.
Where it took everyone else 5 or 10 more years to figure out what she had already figured out. And she and Dave Stewart are just completely different kind of colorists.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
But I mean, I'm looking at this Tokyo Ghost story and the art with the ghost itself, it looks incredible.
Yeah, it's true.
The way it's drawn and colored. I mean, he was a superstar. And I remember the first time going to Comic-Con and seeing him at the DC booth signing. And I started freaking out a little bit internally because he draws the drummer to be, he's himself. The drummer is a self-portrait. And it was literally like seeing a character come to life. I had never experienced that before. And I freaked out a little bit the first time I saw him because it was like looking at the drummer. I mean, this is dynamic. It's exciting.
Yep.
Great craggly Elijah Snowface.
It's that widescreen thing that they talk about, which mostly refers to Brian Hitch, but it's in here too. These panels are all cinematic. They look like storyboards basically in a lot of it. His method is usually not a lot of panels per page.
Yep.
A lot of horizontal panels all the way, 4 or 5, maybe 6 panels total. A lot like Tony Harris. Tony Harris has page layouts like that also. I tend to think of those guys as similar in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It really does look fantastic, and it looks like nobody else and nothing else. And then you've got, like, I don't remember which issue it is. I think it's 4, where they find the underground old spaceship, the sentient spaceship, and the cop is transported into it. And there's it's not a 2-page spread, but there's sort of a wide shot of this guy in there, and this is all this beautiful decoration and design about the, on the inside of the ship. You never see him do that today.
No. Well, you talk about being young and hungry. I mean,
more or less he became a cover guy. He was the in-house cover guy for Dynamite for the most part. And he would do some other stuff.
He did Captain America.
He's doing some Brian Hitch stuff. Well, yeah, but Captain America was a long time ago. I can't remember the last time he did like regular interiors or anything like that.
Star Wars. He did the first couple issues of Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was
right.
The last time I remember him saying it on interiors.
But he's really doing like some big Brian Hitchy kind of stuff in here too. So again, you have that hunger.
Yeah, it really was like doing New Avengers. It was like it was going back to something that was really mind-blowing and fresh.
Man, I will never get those creepy, skinny Doc Savage, Doc Brass legs out of my head. Ugh. As soon as I turned to it, I was like, I never want to see that again. Why is that so creepy?
What was great about this book was that, and I don't know if you saw it or not, but they have one of Warren Ellis' scripts in the back.
I did see that, yeah. I was reading through it.
Did you read through it? I love how grumpy he is in the script, too.
Yeah.
There's one point where he yells at the letterer. He was like, it's not captions, it's word balloons without tails. If I wanted captions, I would tell you captions. And I'm just glad to see he was basically not pretending to be who he was. He was actually that person.
Yeah, or he was just that person to everybody.
It's interesting. I mean, I've never seen one of his scripts before. It was fun to see how he...
I have. I actually remember these from early on. One of the things I learned from is sort of just how sparse he was.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of like... It's a really good... He does a whole page, in less than a page. And so you look and his panel descriptions are very, very sparse.
Well, it's funny because he came out of the Alan Moore... His post-Alan Moore, and he couldn't be more different in terms of how he works.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, but you realize, how much he leaves up to the artist, which is honestly, as far as I understand, it's the way it's supposed to be.
Well, he says it here, too, when they're talking about the alternate Justice League, says, I can give you some ideas for designs, but basically you're here to go nuts, so go nuts. I'll do it, but really I'd rather you do it.
It's incredibly economic, though.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a fun, there's mysteries upon mysteries, and when they figure something out, it unleashes new questions, which is what any good story should do. Whenever you find an answer, you should get 2 more questions from that answer, and it just really was some beautiful storytelling. It's a shame that it ended up being one of those books that became kind of a joke for its schedule, but taken as a whole, it's incredibly fun to read.
Yeah, I mean, we can also look back and say, well, he did finish it. So now at this point, I don't think I've read past what was in this book. So I don't know if it falls off a cliff or what.
The art probably does. I don't remember. I did read it when it came out, but I don't remember. But Cassidy's art did change in 10 years, so there's no way it's going to look as good as it did in the beginning.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
It is. Looks like the next intro is by Joss Whedon. And that one is from 2001. So they did not... commission any new intros. Oh yeah, no, it changes right away. You can see it in the first issue.
I think this is a great book for people to jump onto, to check out. It doesn't require any foreknowledge. These characters are all new, basically.
Yeah.
You don't have to know any backstory. It gives you all. It's all about finding out the backstory of this world, and so it's all revealed through the book itself. I think this is great if you want to sample that era again. You know, Transmetropolitan's a commitment. It's a 60-issue commitment. The Authority. Was it 12 issues they did or whatever it was?
It's not a lot. It's two trades of War and
Ellis. It's fun.
Count Stormwatch.
I liked the Authority a lot, but I think for my money, if you just want to give it a shot, Planetary can't. You know, it's a great place to try. And if you like that, then I would say check out Transmetropolitan and really dig into it, because that's a preacher-esque length. You know,
that's one of my favorite series of all time. Transmetropolitan is a big reason why I'm still doing this stuff that we're doing here, talking about it. I take it back. The beginning for a few issues, at least on book two, are pretty great looking. Yeah, and I mean, I just think as a piece of history, if you're interested in sort of eras of comic books, this is kind of a milestone. You know, part of a milestone of that era. It's absolutely worth reading and just sort of trying to understand, you know, for me, like, to understand where Warren Ellis comes from is to sort of understand where comics in general were taking turns and were sort of setting different kinds of tones than they had been before.
Mm-hmm.
And breaking new ground, which again, like, if you look back, a lot of what is in here I've seen since then. You know, a lot of this became standard. You know, I can see influence from this. You know, I said this was clearly influenced by Alan Moore to a certain extent, but I can see influence from this, you know, in Tom King's work, in all sorts of things. And people who came out of, well, people our age, basically, where they were reading this when they were, you know, in their early mid-20s or something like that, and sort of realizing, hey, this is significant work, and having that spark other ideas. I think this is extremely important in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, he was the guy who nurtured, as you said, Matt Fraction, Brian Wood, Kieran Gillen.
Yep.
That whole class, that whole age of creators literally came out of his forums.
Mm-hmm.
He's that sort of middle piece. You got your Alan Moore, Frank Miller's late 80s guys. Morrison spans that time because he was still doing influential work at the same time Warren Ellis was. And yep. Then coming out of that was Mark Miller, Brian Wood, Kieran Gillen, Matt Fraction, and then you lead to the next wave of guys, which was Jason Aaron, Hickman, all those guys. But Ellis was as important as anybody in that early 2000 bridge time between the late 80s and then what became.
And that was a really sketchy time. So another thing that he brought was sort of, I was like, a mainstream sensibility, basically. It wasn't a guy who was sort of building on superheroes comics past. It wasn't, you know, like, he may have been a student of Roy Thomas, you know, in a way. He may have understood all that stuff and known about it, but he was definitely doing comics that it felt like the idea was you could give these comics to anybody, not just a comic book nerd. And at that time, a comic book nerd was a real thing that people did not brag about being if they had social media, which they didn't. And that's like important. Like, these were comics that were supposed to be cool, which was not something that existed at that point. They were adult. They could be, you know, anybody could pick them up and read them and talk about them the same way if you were reading a novel or watching a cool movie or something like that. It should make them hip pieces of pop culture that were, you know, accessible and interesting and not nerdy. And that, as much as anything, has to do with that sort of tone that we're talking about. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
I think.
For sure. I really do think he defines that 5-year area, but we can squibble over that. But I think, you know, the look of his books, the tone, that feeling of mature adult cool comics.
Yeah. Took me a little while to get to that.
People strove for that after him.
Still are.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, again, well,
he's also exceptionally smart.
Okay, without a doubt.
And you have to be kind of exceptionally smart to pull this off and not feel hacky.
Yeah.
So Morrison's also exceptionally smart and or exceptionally in tune with the universe, and he pulls that off in a different way.
And it's one of those things, like, I don't think you need to be smart to enjoy this, but
no,
I think you
need
to be able to recognize what smart is. You have to be able to go, this is really smart. You know, like, and even if you don't get what that is, even when I stopped reading it before, the reason was, like, I'm not getting it. Like, it wasn't because there was a problem with the work. It's because I was like, I'm not ready for this. And you know, now I, which is really interesting. And again, that sort of, when we're talking about comic books that are not for the comic book reader, that's part of it. Like, there's a sophistication in here that, you know, a lot of other work hadn't had. Because they had nothing to lose.
Right.
I mean, like, in a way.
I think you're right in that Tom King comparison. It sort of feels like the difference between reading a Tom King book now and reading other
books. Oh, yeah. I definitely see that. And he would have been – he's our age, basically. So it would have been the same kind of thing.
So before we close out, did you have, like, a favorite issue here or favorite bit? I really liked the Constantine issue a lot.
I did, too. It was weird.
It was weird, like, but
a lot of it was me trying to – I spent a lot of time, like, parsing as I was reading it. Where I was like, what am I doing here, and why is this good? Like, in a good way, mm-hmm. like I was enjoying sort of trying to figure out what he was getting at. And so, if you were to ask me what my favorite thing is, it was I like an ongoing story, so I like the uncovering of what's going on and watching Snow sort things out.
Oh, that shit!
That's sort of my favorite part of it.
I just figured it out. What issue was the first one I read? It was issue 11.
Yeah,
the Nick Fury issue. That was my first issue of Planetary.
I feel like that was mine, but I'm not sure.
It was the same time. Let's read this book. It would have been the same book issue that came out, you know, that week.
Yeah, I didn't start with this. I started reading Transmetropolitan first out of all this stuff, and then eventually I got around to this probably around the same time as The Authority. I remember I bought a trade.
Well, I read 11. I remember reading it and going, okay, I really have to read the rest of this. So going to eBay immediately and getting the first 10.
I remember that cover, though. I definitely have it.
I love the Nick Fury issue, too, because that one is a great one-shot, but it's also – it reveals a lot of information. So that's
See, I don't think I would have known that was Nick
no,
Fury.
No, no, no. Reading it
a lot.
Reading it now, in the context of it, now I see, you know, how important that issue was. It was a very pivotal issue. I liked the Constantine one. I liked the Frankenstein, Sherlock Holmes, Dracula one.
I kind of did not like any of them.
No, for sure. For sure.
So that – I mean, like, I don't know.
I could have done without the Planetary Authority crossover issue.
Yeah, but that was just like a thing they stuck on at the end. And even I kind of like that because I really like those characters.
Sure.
So I like the interplay. I was interested in how he was relating the two. And he has this thing where a bunch of these characters are born on January 1st, 1900. And that's sort of, you know, Jenny Sparks was. And as soon as they said Elijah Snow born, you know, you're very old. You were born on, you know, January 1st, 1900. I was like, just like Jenny Sparks. You know? And so that all got to me.
This is a great series.
It is.
There's a reason why people stuck with it for 10 years as one or two issues would come out a year.
Yep.
It's one of those really seminal books from the last 20 years.
And it's also a reason that, like, I doubt this was a major seller. You know, I'm sure it was steady enough and probably sold more then than it would now. But it also launched, you know, this is basically responsible for, you know, two people who could write their own ticket for the rest of their career.
Yeah.
Which is pretty interesting. I mean, Ellis had a couple other things going on at the same time that contributed to it. But I always got the sense that if you were a true Warren Ellis, like, nut, this was really...
This was the one.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, Transmetropolitan is the magnum opus, but this is kind of like the cool indie film.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love Transmetropolitan. That's my favorite thing he's ever done, for sure. But I feel like it's almost forgotten in a way. Like, people will talk about Planetary.
These books aren't talked about, really.
Yeah.
We've moved on. There's too much. The fire hose is opened in our mouths, and we can't keep it all.
Well, I think, you know, The Authority, even more than this, it affected superhero comics, I think, not in a great way, because people tried to ape it, and when they did, it was awful.
Well, that's what I was talking about, him being exceptionally smart, is that he could do the posturing and the badass thing where it felt natural and it felt like it made sense, whereas a lesser writer would try to do that, it would come off as...
crass,
hacky, yeah. Crass, and
yep.
I didn't even like when Mark Miller took over. I thought it was bad after that.
Yep, it was drawn by Frank Quitely.
It was.
I don't know how I could. Who knows? I think.
But it's been 20 years, so maybe it's good.
I think you would tell the difference. You would say, oh, that's his voice. That's this voice. I think Miller was definitely trying to. I don't know if ape it is the right word, but he was trying to fit in with it. I would probably notice the tone shift a lot more now than I did then.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember being incredibly like, who the hell is this artist? Because, you know, Brian Hitch left and I was like, well, there's no point of, oh my God.
But that was the minority opinion. I remember at the time,
yeah,
people were like, what the hell is this? After Brian Hitch, because Brian Hitch is very polished and clean and very traditionally superhero, and Quietly comes in and everybody's kind of lumpy and... they have those Quietly faces, and I remember specifically on iFanboy, people were like, what has happened to the art? And what was happening was awesome.
They were very wrong.
Yes. They were. So Planetary Book 1, it covers the first 14 issues plus an annual plus a Planetary Authority crossover. Book 2, which I just downloaded while we were talking because I didn't know it was out, covers, I guess, the final issue, 15 to 27, plus I assume there might be some extras in there as well.
Yeah. It's also 430-something pages. So
this one's 426 pages, so this is a bang-for-your-buck kind of situation.
But it wasn't like a slog. I read it in 2 days.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, oh, you know, it is an economic page. I didn't feel like I was shortchanged. I wasn't flat, but it just, it's a page turner.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just a lot of fun. And it's a great example of that era, that Wild West period we talked about before, where coming out of Marvel's bankruptcy, there was this great period for comics that happened before Marvel sold itself to Disney and all these things. Not that I'm blaming that, but this is the time period. This is sort of the benchmarks of it. It was a great time. A lot of great comics came out of that period. I'm glad we're getting to check out some of them.
Yeah. I think you're not going to hang us on this, but I think we might do another era next time.
A different era.
Different era. We're going to go backwards another era.
It gets dicier the further back you go for a while. Yeah. And then it gets good again.
It's going to dip.
When you go back one more stop on the train, you're in a bad neighborhood, and then you get back to being a good neighborhood again.
This is like that time I went the wrong way on the BART in Oakland.
So there you go. Planetary Book 1, go to ifanboy.com. There'll be a post for this show. You can tell us what you thought of this series. If you read Planetary in the day, let's have some Planetary reminiscing. That'll be fun.
Yeah. Or if you have.
So this was the Booksplode show. As we said, it's the sister show to the Talksplode, which is Josh's interview show. Last month, he interviewed Terry Moore. Next month, who knows? It could be anybody. Maybe it'll be Warren Ellis.
It's definitely not going to be Warren Ellis.
So check that out, ifanboy.com. Of course, you can always listen to our weekly Pick of the Week show, where Josh and I, and sometimes a special guest, will talk about the week's comics. All of it's happening at ifanboy.com. Thanks for listening. My name is Connor.
I'm Josh. Thank you. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.